I would first of all like to thank all of you for kindly dedicating your precious time to come and hear this most sublime and urgent message of Bhagavad Gita. You know, in our lives, the most valuable thing we have is every precious moment that God has given us. Because time is priceless. If you lose any amount of money by hard work, there is a good chance you can gain it back. If you lose real estate, somehow or other, if you work hard, you can get that back too. Even if you lose your reputation and the dignity of your proud position in society, there's a good possibility you can gain that back also. But one moment that is wasted, you cannot buy that moment back for all the wealth in the entire creation. Our Guru Maharaj tells a story about a very wealthy king. He was a Maharaj. He lived just about 70 years ago here in India, near the Rajasthan state. And he had fabulous wealth, incredible amounts of power. And he was very sick. He was on his deathbed. And he told his doctor that there are so many things that are left undone that I want to finish before I die. I will give you most of my fortune if you can just grant me one more year to live. And the doctor told him, I'm sorry to say, my dear sir, if you gave me all the money in the entire world, I cannot even give you one more minute than you are allotted. So really, time is the most precious thing we have in our life. This child is confirming the urgency of what I am trying to relate to you. Crying is a sense of urgency. When a baby cries, he wants his mother to know that there is an urgent emergency. You better take care of me. Okay? So this little child, its cry is like an exclamation point to what I am saying. That it is an emergency that we understand this principle about how valuable our time is. It is explained in Srimad Bhagavatam, Ayur harati vai pungsham udyan astam chayan asho tasya ratayatano uttama shloka varataya. That with every rising and every setting of the sun, we are one day closer to death. But for those who utilize their precious time to hear and chant the glories of the Supreme Lord, to understand the true purpose of life, with every rising and setting of the sun, they are one day closer to eternal life. There is a saying in the English language, time and tide wait for no man. For those of us who are getting a little older, we have this realization that every year we age, it seems the time goes that much faster. When you're a little child and you're in school and you're waiting for summer vacation, it seems like centuries. Even when we're just waiting for the weekend when we can enjoy, that week seems like ages. Do you remember? But as we grow older, Years go by. Our 50th, 51st, 52nd birthday, they seem like days, like minutes. And soon, we're at the threshold of departing this particular body, and we look back and think, where has my life gone? It seems like it's only been a moment. So therefore, if we understand the value of every precious moment, the most important part of our intelligence is to utilize every moment to the greatest benefit of ourselves as well as others. For those of you who may be in business, you know that the most important part of success in business is wise investment. Huh? And foolish investment, even if you do everything else very well and work extremely hard, you will not be successful. So how we invest each moment of our life is the most important consideration of our human intelligence. It is described in Srimad Bhagavatam, Nayam deho deha bhajam nu loke kastan kaman arhati vibhujam jay tapo divyam putra kayena sapvam sujejasyam brahma sokyan panantam. This is spoken by the Supreme Lord who appeared in the form of Rishabhdev. Lord Rishabhdev was a great king, and he had many sons. And when it was time for him to retire and enthrone his eldest son, whose name was Bharat, as the king, he wanted to instruct them in the most important things to know in life. You know this great king Bharat, because he heard his father's words of wisdom with such attention and applied them to his life, he became such a great leader of men that this great nation of India was named for millenniums after him, Bharat Varsha, the land of King Bharat. So in his opening shloka, King Rishabhdev explained to his sons that now that you have attained this valuable, rare, and precious human form of life, do not waste your moments. Simply seeking after the necessities of the body, those pleasures are available to the dogs, to the hogs, and to the lower species. They are eating, they are sleeping, they are mating, and they are defending. A dog is running on four legs, and by our great technology, we are now running on four wheels. But the purpose of running from one place to another is the same. It's the same consciousness. The hog is eating the refuse in the street, and we are eating nice foodstuff. We prepare it with great care and attention. But the consciousness of eating nice, tasteful things in order to maintain the body and enjoy is the same. The pigeons, they are everywhere, and they are mating and producing offspring. And they also protect their children when they're young. Human beings are also doing that, maybe in a more sophisticated fashion, but the purpose, the mentality, is the same. And we are spending so many quadrillions of dollars. I read an article, so many quadrillions of dollars have been spent since World War II throughout the world in developing armaments, bombs, and weapons. And the dog, he's fighting with his teeth. And the tiger's fighting with his claws. What is the difference? To defend, to defend our bodies, to defend our homes, to defend our family members. These things are necessary. But in and of themselves, however sophisticated we may engage in these activities, it is of the same nature as the consciousness of an animal. What differentiates this human birth from all the lower species, which makes this human birth so rare, so valuable? We have the power to inquire into the true nature of truth. Who am I? Where am I coming from? Where am I going? Who is God? How to live in harmony with God? How to realize that which is beyond my birth and my death? The Brahma Sutra explains Atato Brahma Jigyasa, that human life begins when we inquire into the nature of the Absolute Truth. Until then, qualitatively, we are of the polished animal sector of society. And this is what we mean by religion, yoga. The word yoga comes from Sanskrit. It means to reunite, to reconnect the soul to its source, the Atma to the Paramatma. To be released from illusion and reunited with our nature, which is truth. And the word religion comes from the Latin word religio, which means to bind one back to one's source. The words mean the same thing. But what is religion? Unfortunately, today, people have such misconceptions of religion. This great land of India is known throughout the world as the land of Dharma, the land of religion. It's your greatest export. I remember when I was 19 years old, I didn't know anything about India, except I was taught in schools that there's poverty and that there's starvation. That's all they teach in the Western schools about India. Nobody wants to go to a place to find that. But there was one other thing that I heard about India, that of all places in the world, this is where you go to learn about God. This is where such great saints, such sages, such rishis, yogis, this is where they are imparting knowledge of God. It is the land of Dharma. So when I was 19, I was going to college. And I was studying philosophy and religion. And these big, big professors with their PhDs, they were teaching me. And I had all respect for them. They were doing their job quite well. But what could they teach me about God? They were simply theoretically explaining what they had learned in books. But they had no training. They had no realization. They had no experience. So I thought, if I want to learn about God, I should go to India. So somehow I made it to London, and then I hitchhiked. You know what is hitchhiking? Where you put your thumb and wait for someone to pick you up. And I came to India. It took me 8 months. Now you get on airplane, it takes 12 hours. It took me 8 months to make that same journey. So, not only myself, but since time immemorial, people have been coming to India to learn the truth. And our spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, he left India with only 40 rupees. And he went on a boat, Sumati Murarji of the Scindia steamship lines. She gave him free passage because she felt sorry for him. He had no money. But he wanted to preach Sanatana Dharma in the West. Don't you go, Swamiji? But you're an old man. You're 70. I think you will die. It's too cold. You should stay here. He said, no, no. Better to die doing what I know is right than to go on living. Hundreds and thousands of people, their lives were transformed. They were changed by reading this Bhagavad Gita as he was explaining it. Even one of the greatest authors of the West, Thoreau, and his disciple Emerson, you have heard them. They explained in their writings that compared to the Bhagavad Gita, all the literatures of the Western world are puny and trivial. Emerson wrote that when you read the Bhagavad Gita, it is as if an entire spiritual empire is speaking to you. The wisdom of India is so great. It is so deep, so profound. But unfortunately, the people of India, who have inherited this spiritual knowledge, who have inherited the highest, purest spiritual culture in history, they do not even know what they have. In general, people are chasing after the things of the West. And the people of the West are frustrated with what they have. They're looking for something beyond. Truly, the greatest wealth in all of creation is the words of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. But unless we hear them in the spirit of Arjuna, we cannot truly appreciate or understand it. Arjuna was not hearing Gita from Krishna simply like an armchair speculator, simply as a profession, or just to become a wise man. He was hearing Bhagavad Gita in a sense of complete urgency. Knowledge is like a seed, and our heart is like an agricultural field. Unless the heart is properly, what do you plow it with the oxen or with the tractors, unless it is receptive to receiving the seed will simply go and it will be lost. That sense of urgency, that submissiveness that Arjuna had when he approached Krishna, is what is required for anyone to truly understand the Gita. It is not simply a philosophy. The Gita is a way of life. It is certainly a profound philosophy, but a philosophy that is meant to transform our entire consciousness and enlighten our life. Arjuna was standing on a battlefield. Why was it arranged in this way? Of all places for spiritual knowledge to be spoken, why a battlefield? Krishna could have spoken to Arjuna in a cave in the Himalayas. He could have spoken to him in an ashram or on the bank of a holy river. This is usually where people go to hear from sadhus, huh? But Krishna spoke to Arjuna in the least likely place you would expect to find transcendental knowledge, in a battlefield, on the brink of a war. And Arjuna, who accepted Krishna as his charioteer, he told Krishna, you bring this charioteer, you bring this chariot between these two armies. I want to see who has come to fight. And Krishna, who was always obliged to please his devotees. He brought Arjuna's chariot, and when Arjuna saw family members, relatives, loved ones, friends on both sides, he became completely consumed in the bodily concept of life. He became bewildered. He became confused. He began to speak so many words to Krishna to explain why I will not fight this war. He presented on a rational basis, on a philosophical basis, on a social basis, perfect arguments why he should leave that battlefield, abandon his duty. But even though he had so many wonderful intellectual arguments, he was bewildered. He was confused. His limbs were trembling. His mouth became dry. His skin became pale. Tears were flowing from his eyes. He was trembling so bad that his Gandiva brooch fell from his hand. And then with folded palms, he spoke to Krishna. Karapanya doso pahata swabhava prishyamitvam dharma sanudacheha. Yet Straya Shanbushi Tambushti Ham Shishyasti Ham Sarman Hong Papanam. That my dear Krishna, I really do not know what is my duty. I am confused. I do not know what is religion and what is irreligion. I do not know what is to be done and what is not to be done. In this condition, I submit to you, my Lord. Please instruct me. And Krishna's first words to Arjuna, Asochyanam vasochastvam pragyavadam shabashate gatasama gatasamsa nanusanjati pandataha, said, my dear Arjuna, what you're saying is correct. You are a fool. That's the first correct thing you have said all day when you said you are a fool. You are lamenting for that which is not worthy of grief. Before you spoke this, I had nothing to say. As long as you thought you knew what was happening, what do I have to tell you? But now that you have become humble, now that you understand the urgency of this message of mine, now you are a proper recipient to hear my words. This is very important. Even in the name of religion, we see Muslims and Hindus killing one another, Buddhists and Hindus killing one another, Sikhs and Hindus killing one another, Christians and Christians killing one another of various denominations, Christians and Jews, Jews and Muslims. Throughout the world, in the name of God, people are killing each other. In the name of nationalism, in the name of casteism, people are killing each other over all varieties of ignorance under so many names. This ignorance is the real disease that is causing so much pain and disharmony in this world. Individually as well as the social body, there has to be a good surgical operation to remove this ignorance and allow the natural health of our pure godly consciousness to manifest and do good for this world. So Dr. Sri Govinda came here out of compassion to help you understand this sublime message of Krishna. But we must receive that message in the same spirit as Arjuna, not as an entertainment, but with an urgent need, with a desperate feeling that I must understand what is truth. I must transform my life according to God's words. And if you hear in that spirit, every syllable of the Gita will bring about newer, fresher, and more sublime realizations of God and the purpose of life. This world is a battlefield. That is why Krishna spoke on the battlefield. Because that battlefield represents the condition that we are all in this world. There are so many opposing forces. There is the forces of materialism. There is so much propaganda trying to inundate us, to control us, to buy this product, to enjoy these various senses and mind. And there's also the propaganda to become detached, to become pure in heart, to become a servant of God and all living beings. The material propaganda is you are the master and you are the enjoyer. And the propaganda of Gita is that you are meant to be enjoyed by God in your every act, every word, and every thought. And you are meant to be a servant, a humble servant of God and all of His creation, all humanity. The real fulfillment of all the desires of the soul will come to the degree we accept this position, that I am the humble servant of the Lord. And a humble servant of all my brothers and sisters in this world. And how to serve? The Gita teaches that you can serve, you can perform the perfection of yogic process by performing your duty in divine consciousness. In the third chapter, Krishna says, Karma neva hisamsidhim ashtita janakadaya loka sangraham evapi sampasyam karatum arhasi. Even kings like Janaka and others attain the perfectional stage by performance of prescribed duties. Therefore, just for the sake of educating the people in general, you should perform your work. Yajya racharati strest tad tad eveta rojana sayat pramanam kurute lokas tad anuvaratate. Whatever action is performed by a great man, common men follow in his footsteps, and whatever standard he sets by his exemplary acts, all the world pursues. Krishna is explaining here that Arjuna, you have a family. Not only one, Arjuna had three families. He had three wives. And he also had such a duty that he was a warrior, he was a politician, and he was a diplomat. Perhaps the most unlikely of all occupations that we would consider that you can be spiritual in, huh? Krishna did not tell him, give up your duties and take sannyas. He did not tell him, leave behind your families. He told him, you can be a guru for all society by your example if you just perform your work in divine consciousness. Now, there is a misconception that work is worship. Where in the Gita does Krishna say that work is worship? Krishna says in Gita, what type of work is worship? Jagyarata kamanon yatra lokumam kanama bandana taratam kanama kontaya mukta sanga samachara. When work is done in devotion to God, in service to humanity, that work will liberate you from all the bondage of material creation. But any work that is done for your own selfish motives, without worship and respect to God, that work will only cause bondage. So the Bhagavad Gita is teaching how we can apply spiritual consciousness to our everyday life. Arjuna was a warrior. Krishna did not preach to him to change his occupation. He preached to him to change his consciousness. He didn't tell him just work is worship, because Duryodhana was working just like Arjuna. What was the difference between Duryodhana and Arjuna? They were both riding on chariots. They were both shooting arrows. They were both wearing the same kind of armor. They both had a flag on top of their chariot. They were both making decisions how to organize the different phalanxes of their soldiers. Arjuna and Duryodhana, as far as their occupation, were doing exactly the same thing. Yet Duryodhana is condemned and Arjuna is glorified. Why? Because Arjuna heard the Gita. And he did his duty in divine consciousness, in devotion to God, for the upliftment of humanity. Selflessly, as a sacrifice, he did his service. And Duryodhana did the same thing, but not in respect to the word of God. He did it for his own prestige, for his own power, to fulfill his own greed. This is what Gita is teaching. How to change our consciousness. And unless we want that change of consciousness, nothing will take place. It is said, he convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. We must approach Gita with a true and sincere desire to understand the truth and to live a life in pursuance of truth. Arjuna heard the Gita from Krishna. Similarly, it is the great saintly persons, those persons who are truly humble and dedicated to serving God and uplifting humanity, not people who want to become famous as reciters of Bhagavat, but people who genuinely are concerned with your welfare and who want to train you and teach you, not expecting anything in return except the fulfillment of seeing you become blissful in relationship to God. Such a selfless person who is repeating the Gita as he has heard it from his guru, who has heard it from his guru, not someone who is simply using intellectual gymnastics to present a wonderful philosophy for his own aggrandizement. But if we hear the Gita, if we hear the truth from such a person, our lives can be transformed. Practically speaking, how could we in the city of Bombay apply the Gita to our life? The first and most important thing that is explained in all the great scriptures, not only of India, but of the whole world, is the absolute necessity of sadhu sangha, association with saintly persons on a regular basis. Many of you are parents. You know that who your children associate with is what they will become. Huh? Parents are very much concerned who their children are associated with, because it is a law of nature. According to our association, we take on those qualities. You put an iron rod in fire, it becomes red hot. You put an iron rod in ice, it becomes ice cold. Whatever we associate with, our consciousness assimilates those qualities. If we associate with saintly people, our values become virtuous. Our desire to live in harmony with God becomes natural. If we associate with sinful people, greedy people, materialistic people, we will become polluted in consciousness by those qualities. Now, of course, in our work, oftentimes, we are bound to associate with such people. What can we do? Just like if you're going in to a diseased area, you should take inoculation regularly so that you will not be affected by that disease. Sometimes doctors go to a place where there's smallpox or there's typhoid or other epidemics, cholera, and they get their inoculations so that they can go and they can do good to help these people. But without the inoculations, they will become what the people have. They will become a part of the problem. To regularly associate with God's devotees, with people who are truly and genuinely and honestly pursuing spiritual values in life, will give us a spiritual strength by which we can go into the world and maintain our God consciousness. Regularly, it is explained in Bhagavatam, Nasta praesya bhadresu nityam bhagavati sevaya bhagavati uttamashloke bhakti bhavati ananaistaki, that by regularly associating with saintly people and hearing the Bhagavat, hearing the truth of God, all impurities in our heart are cleansed. So this is the first and most important consideration to make our lives holy, is regular association with sadhus. But what is a sadhu? A sadhu is not one who shaves his head, or one who wears saffron, or one who has matted hair, or one who walks around naked, or one who begs for rotis. That is not the meaning of sadhu in the Shastra. Tithik shiva karunaka suhridam sarabhutanam ajata satrava santa sadhava sadhu bhushanam. A sadhu is one who is self-controlled, who is a friend of all living beings, who is equal to everyone, who is compassionate, who is merciful, and who always speaks the word of God. Who is a humble servant in the way he speaks the word of God. To associate with such people, Mahatsevam dwaram ahuravam upes tamodwaram yoshita sanghi sangam. It is explained that associating with such saintly people opens the doors to liberation. Tamodwaram yoshita sanghi sangam. But by associating with worldly people, the doors to lower realms of ignorance are opened wide. This is the first and most important consideration. Second, in our own daily lives, how to develop a spiritual foundation by which we can build upon in everything we do. Whether we are doctors, whether we are lawyers, whether we are businessmen, whether we are judges, whether we are farmers, whether we are sannyasis, whether we are students, whether we are housewives or secretaries, whatever our natural inclination may be in this world, we must build upon the foundation of truth. Every day, we recommend that before beginning our work, we set our priorities straight. That our first business as human beings is to develop self-realization and to become pure in heart, instruments in the hands of God for the benefit of others. Therefore, first thing in the day, we should meditate. According to the Shastra, the simplest, the most sublime form of meditation which anyone can perform, even a child, is the chanting of God's name. God has many names. In our movement, according to the Kali Santarana Upanishad, in this age of Kali, the Maha Mantra is especially powerful. To chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Hare Ram, Ram Ram. The name of God is none different than God. All the power and truth of God is contained within His names. Recently, someone was telling me that one meditation teacher was saying, you should not meditate on God's name. It's just a word. It is not a word. It is a divine transcendental vibration. Sripad Shankaracharya, Sri Ramanujacharya, Sri Nimbarakacharya, Sri Madhvacharya, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the greatest saints, the most compassionate servants of society throughout history, they all claimed the divinity and the purity and the ultra potency of the name of God. And all the scriptures declare the same. Aho bhataswapachal dhogariyam yaj jivagre vartate namatubhyam. It is said, even if one is born in a family of what we consider untouchables, if he sincerely chants the name of God, such a person can be the guru for the whole world. He should be considered better than a Brahmin, because his life becomes pure. This is the power of the name of God. So every day, let us begin by regularly chanting God's name. Enechi ashadi maya nashibaru lagi harina mahamantra lao tumi magi. We should take the name of God as a medicine. The guru, the sadhus, they are like doctors. They are giving us this medicine. Medicine must be taken regularly in order to have proper effect. Even if you have good medicine, if you do not take it according to the prescription regularly, it will have minimal effects. Each day, we should begin by chanting regularly. That is why we sometimes use the mala. It regulates our chanting. We chant 2 malas, or 4 malas, or 16 malas. But we have a regular time every day where we have nothing else to do or think about but absorb our consciousness in the sweet and beautiful ambrosial sound of God's name. Now at the beginning, as you're chanting, your mind is going to run everywhere else. Huh? You have this experience? It is natural. Do not worry. Because now your mind is like a restless baby. Huh? A child. What is the nature? Every mother knows. If you're not a mother, you ask any mother. Even as a sannyasi, I'm not either a father or a mother, but I'm always watching, and I see this. Children are always running wherever they should not be. They always want to grab on to what they're not supposed to grab on to. Do you all agree? And what is the duty of the mother? Just bring it back, bring it back, bring it back. Wherever the child runs, to some broken piece of glass or to the window, you just keep bringing it back. You can't blame the child. It's its nature. But by constantly bringing it back, that child becomes trained and knows what's right and what's wrong and stays right where he's supposed to be. We have to train our mind just like we train our children, because our mind is like a restless child. You're chanting the name of God and it's running to your business. And it's running to your family affairs, and it's running to your everywhere else. Huh? Wherever it goes, just Hare Krishna. Just bring it back to the holy name. And then it runs and bring it back. And just by bringing it back, attentively, keeping it with the name, the mind becomes purified. The mind is meant to reflect into this world through our senses the love of God. But now, our mind is so dirty and dusty with so many attachments and so many bewilderments and so many egoistic ideas that the truth of God's love that is within our hearts is going into our mind, but it's not reflecting anything. It's only reflecting dust. The chanting of the name of God, Chetudarpanam Marajanam Bhavamaha Devagri Nirvapanam, cleanses the mirror of the mind. And when it's cleansed, the mind becomes the most beautiful, pristine instrument to reflect God's love through everything we do. So that we perform our work in compassion rather than greed. We perform our work in truth rather than in ignorance, with honesty rather than dishonesty, so that we can perform our work in a spirit of love rather than envy, so that we want to help others. And what we do with our money, naturally, we gain money, we will want to utilize that money for purposes of charity. Charity of the mind, charity of the body, and charity of the soul. To give food, to give hospitalization, that is charity of the body. To give clothing, to encourage others, to be good to others, to be a friend, that is charity to the mind. And to give transcendental knowledge, to give facilities for people to be educated in spiritual life, that is charity to the soul. They all three must be going on side by side. Because actually, many rich people today are more poverty-stricken than the poor spiritually. So to the poor, we should give them what they need for their bodies, but we shouldn't neglect the rich either. We shouldn't discriminate like that. They are suffering too. Do you know in America it is a statistic that 80% of the people in the upper income brackets have to take sleeping pills to fall asleep? What does that mean? They have so much money, they have so much prestige, they have big beautiful houses, silk and water beds, all kinds of guards and security devices around their home, big, beautiful Cadillacs, Continentals, Mercedes. And they're so miserable. They're in so much anxiety. They can't even sleep. They have to take a drug to fall asleep. Yet here in Bombay, I see people just sleeping without even a pillow right on the bare street, and they don't take sleeping pills. And they sleep within seconds. So who's happier? Who's having more peace of mind in life? It is true that all sectors of society are in need of the charity of transcendental knowledge. So first of all, we should utilize what we have for the betterment of others. And for the betterment of our own family members. After we chant the holy names every morning, this is our humble recommendation, make a little temple in your house. Put it in a nice place. If possible, a prominent place. Sometimes I see here in India, people have temples in private closets. So that when sadhus come, they open the closet. But when anybody else comes, they close it. But it is true. We should show our children, by our example, that we love God. Children, when they're young, they may not intellectually understand so much. But the impressions that they see go deeply into their consciousness and mold their whole lives. You can tell children something, but what you do will influence them, not what you say. We should have a little temple. What we cook, we should cook pure foodstuffs in our house. We should offer it to God in devotion. make it prasad. That will sanctify our consciousness and the consciousness of our whole families. Offer a little puja, not as a ritual, but as an offering of devotion. When we offer the incense, when we offer the lamp, what we are doing, in fact, is we are offering our heart's love through this medium in devotion to God. It is such a wonderful, beautiful, and sublime process of meditation. It is a meditation. It is not a ritual, if it is done correctly. And every day, we should bathe our consciousness in the Holy Scripture. Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavat. If we read the Gita every day regularly, we sit down, we hear it. If possible, discuss it with your family members. Contemplate on what you read. And then you take your prasad, and then you go to work. These three simple things, regularly associating with sadhus, chanting the holy name every morning, and preferably whenever other time in the day we have, before we take rest. We can chant all time, whenever our mind during the day we can take the name of God. But in the morning, specifically, exclusively only that. Give it 15 minutes, gradually half hour, gradually an hour. Make it a priority. Utilize these precious moments of this human existence. Read the Bhagavad Gita every morning. Then you go to your work. And you'll see that you will be surcharged with spiritual energy. And that spiritual energy gradually, as you practice this formula, will integrate in every aspect of your life to make you truly a spiritual human being. And we should live pure lives. According to the Shastra, the four regulative principles, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling, no meat eating, we should live a very pure life. Sri Govinda explained these things to you. If we simply apply these principles, we find how living the Gita becomes practical. It's no longer just a theoretical conception, but it becomes a way of life. And absorb these principles of Gita, not to be attached to success or failure, honor or dishonor, pleasure or pain. Be attached to doing your duty in devotion to God. Huh? And doing it well. So at this time, I would like to really thank all of you for your kind attention. And if there's any questions, I can try to answer them. Any questions either in regard to what we have spoken today or any questions you may have of anything spoken over the last 8 days during the course? Yes? Please speak loudly because there's noises behind me. Let me ask you this. If God is omnipresent, is he not in the murti too? Huh? If God is omnipresent, he is in the murti? You accept that? Okay, so Vyavasayatmaka buddhya ekeha kuru nandana. Manmana bhava madbhakto majajimna namaskaru. Krishna says we must fix our consciousness on him. It is true that by his energy, he is expanding himself everywhere. Huh? But be honest and be realistic. Not to me, but to yourself. Are you able to fix your mind in love and devotion on God everywhere and in everything? Huh? Therefore, the Lord is so merciful and so kind that he reveals to us wonderful methods by which we can completely absorb our consciousness in him. One is through his name. God is, the name is a Murti of God that is appearing in sound that we can carry with us everywhere. Huh? And the Murti in the temple is a manifestation that God is so kindly giving us to completely focus our external senses on him, to serve him. You can bathe God. You can offer foodstuff to God. You can meditate on the beauty of God. You can completely absorb your attention in the Murti. It's simply a most wonderful and sublime form of meditation, which awakens our natural serving propensity and awakens our love for God. God has given it as a wonderful facility and opportunity for us to fix our mind on him, to love him and to serve him. Huh? There is a need to keep our mind fixed on God. Huh? That is a need. And this is a wonderful way to do so. And it's a practical way. We should offer our respects to the Lord. Are we offering our respects to the clocks and the molecules in the air? But the deity in the temple. When we offer our obeisances to that deity is accepting on behalf of everything and everyone. Huh? Just like if you want to mail a letter somewhere, you put it in the proper post box and it will get there. The Murti is like the post box for God. Huh? He's receiving our love in that form. Although the Lord is in the spiritual world, and although that Lord, that same Lord is manifesting through his energy, his omnipresence, we are fulfilling all of that by simply offering our respectful obeisances to the post box of the Murti. Huh? It is getting delivered to God everywhere, in Vaikuntha, and in between every atom. Huh? You should do the best you can. The name of God is the most sublime process. Because if it's possible in your home to set up a little temple, it's a wonderful thing. If it is not, still, the name of God can be worshipped in the temple of your heart. Huh? Is there any other questions? The correlation between mind and soul is explained in Gita. Bhumirapono vayu kamano budrevacha ahankara iti yami bina pakriti rashtata aparayami tashpanyam prakriti indrime param jiva bhuta mahabaho yayetam taryate jagat. That there are eight material elements, each one slightly more subtle than the one before. The grossest element is earth. Finer than earth is water. Finer than water is fire. Finer than fire is air. And finer than air is space or ether. These are the five basic elements. Now, ether or space is considered by Krishna to be a gross element. Huh? What is more subtle than even space? The mind. Can you see a thought? Can you touch a thought? Can you taste a thought? None of the gross senses can witness a thought. The thought can only be witnessed by the mind. The thought is the expression of the mind. It is a subtle element, but it is a material element. Finer than the mind is the intelligence. The nature of the mind is that first we have a sense object. That sense object is experienced by the senses, either the eyes or the ears or the tongue or the flesh, huh? Or the nose. The mind responds to that sensory object. The mind either says, I like it or I don't like it, right? I want it or I don't want it. I love it or I hate it. Huh? The mind is accepting and rejecting. The mind is hankering for what it doesn't have and lamenting, or hankering for what it wants and lamenting for what it loses. This is the function of the mind, right? Simply to perceive things through the senses and to react. Now the intelligence is subtler than the mind. The function of the intelligence is to actually discriminate. If the mind sees a beautiful object, the mind, through the senses, I want it, then the intelligence comes and starts figuring out all kinds of ways to get it. Huh? Now, subtler than the intelligence is ahankar, the ego. The ego is the subtle most material element because it is the ego that identifies with this whole phenomena of the intelligence, the mind, and the gross body, thinking that it's me. Beyond the ego is the soul. The soul is the real you. The soul is the person. The soul is the observer, the witness. The soul is the source of life. And when the soul identifies that I am eternal, full of knowledge, full of bliss. I am part of God. Jivara Swarupoi Krishnera Nityadas. I am an instrument of God. And this mind, intelligence, ego, and all these gross elements, they are all covering me. And I'm meant to use all of them very nicely in God's service, for God's glory in this world. It is not that because we realize we're not this body that we neglect the body. You realize that you're not your automobile, but you take good care of it because you have a purpose to serve through it. It is true this body is temporary. We are the eternal soul. We are not this body. But God has given us this body. And to mistreat it and to misuse it is ungrateful. If I let you use my car and you go crash it, that's ungrateful. Use it properly. So therefore, the nature of the pure soul is to take the body, the mind, the ego, the intelligence, everything, and use it in compassion and love for the world as an instrument of God's love. That is the true function of the soul in this world. And when we die, it's like changing the dress. We realize that there is no death. But when we come under the influence of false ego, this is what I'm talking about, is real ego, pure ego. But false ego, ahankar, is when we forget who we really are, the soul. And we think, I am this body. I am the enjoyer. I am this mind. And we dedicate our whole life to fulfilling the fastidious and unquenchable demands of the body and mind. Huh? So therefore, the mind is a material element that is temporarily covering the soul, just as the body is a material element that is temporarily covering the soul. When we purify the mind, then we could utilize our body also in pursuance of truth. But when our mind is conditioned and contaminated by material desires and attachments, forgetfulness of God, then the soul simply becomes the servant of the mind, rather than using the mind in the service of God. You understand? Yes. Yes. Because the mind goes wherever the soul goes, as long as it's transmigrating through the different species of life in this world. Mind does not die with the body. When the body dies, the mind, intelligence, and false ego carry the soul to the next body according to that soul's karma. Now, why do we not remember our previous births so much? Sometimes we do, but usually we don't. Why? It's natural. How many things do you remember that you did or that you thought when you were 1 year old? Anything? Can you remember anything you did, said, or saw when you were 1 year old? Raise your hand in this room if you can. What to speak of 6 months? Anybody? What to speak of when you were in the womb of your mother? Do you remember what she was eating and what it was like there? Now, you know you were 1 year old, and you know you were 6 months, and you know you were in the womb of your mother. Why you can't remember any of these things? Because it was a long time ago. If you can't remember that, how are you going to remember what was before that? Which means your previous birth. If you can't remember what you did earlier in this birth, how do you expect to remember what was before that? But the impressions are there. The impressions that you experienced when you were in the womb of your mother and when you were 1 year old are still within your consciousness now. Similarly, all the impressions of our previous activities and desires, although we may not intellectually be able to identify them, they are all stored up within our mind, birth after birth after birth. And sometimes, due to extraordinary type of karma, we can actually remember and identify with our previous actions, our previous places, and our previous thought patterns of previous lives. Any other questions? Yes. No, unmixed. Thank you.
It is very good. He should offer a receipt.
Somebody saying something? We should do good. We should be charitable. We should be pious. But the human form of life affords something that is even more than that. Huh? As I was saying, there's charity to the body, charity to the mind, and charity to the soul. You can feed a hungry man. We do it every day. But that person's going to become hungry again. It's a good thing. But if you can teach a person how to be enlightened in devotional consciousness, revive a person's original spiritual consciousness, that person never has to be lonely again. That person has achieved a state beyond death. That is the greatest charity. Why not utilize our human birth for the greatest thing available? We all have the opportunity. The only qualification is the desire. In regard to your question about karma being mixed, if you do something good like that, that is good. Why should anyone say anything against it? It's a wonderful thing. But the problem is, due to the conditioning of your mind and senses, at the next moment, you may do something that's not good. Huh? In this way, good and bad karma is all mixed up in this day and age. Because our propensity in our mind, as long as there's greed and anger and lust and pride and illusion in us, it's just a matter of time till we're going to do something that's not pious. Huh? Sometimes we do something pious, sometimes we do something impious. In this sense, it's mixed. And to do something purely pious means even within your heart, you have no selfish motivation whatsoever. But then the next moment you do something selfish. Right? Isn't that true? So in this way we can very easily and practically understand how good and bad karma is very, very mixed up in this day and age. But there is Shuddha Sattva. When your mind and heart is completely pure, free from lust and envy and greed and anger and pride, then you're on the spiritual platform. That is beyond karma. That is pure goodness. But even when you're in the state of consciousness of pure goodness, because you're in this world, still your body and mind is going to make mistakes. Huh? It's the way of the world. But if our motive is pure, there's no reaction. There's no karmic reaction. Can I answer your question? Yes, sir. I can't hear you if you can speak louder. It is said in the Shastra, Nama Chintamani Krishna Chaitanya Ras Vigraha, that the name of God is the incarnation of God that is always present within this world. That all the power, all the glory, all the purity of God is within His name. All the beauty and the sweetness and the love of God is within His name. Kali Kale Namarupe Krishna Avatar. It is explained in the age of Kali, God incarnates within the sound of His name. So therefore, when we are chanting the name of God, we are actually connecting our consciousness directly with God. Om apavitra pavitro va sarvavastam gatoki va yasmarek pundarikaksham sabayabhyantarasuchi. And Krishna, one name is Pavitra. Bhagavan is all pure. If we associate with what is all pure, we become purified. If you associate with God, you become godly. And the Lord is so easily accessible through the beautiful sound of His name. Yes, sir.
The Advaita philosophy, as expounded by the Adi Shankaracharya, is not acquiescing by the Krishna consciousness philosophy, because of there are chances of hypocrisy in the Advaita philosophy. That is what I heard from the lecture series here. Now, what is the guarantee that in the Krishna consciousness philosophy there won't be any hypocrisy?
There is also hypocrisy, not in the philosophy, but in people who do not follow the philosophy, but who claim to. Hypocrisy means that we are claiming to be followers. We are preaching one thing, but we are doing something else. We find that in every religion, including Krishna consciousness. We don't say that there's hypocrisy in the Advaita philosophy of Sripad Shankaracharya, but there may be hypocrites who follow it, just like there is no hypocrisy in Vaishnav Dharma, but there may be hypocrites that follow it. But the essential difference between the Advaita philosophy and Advaita philosophy is simply that of servitude. The Advaita philosophy explains the realization of one aspect of God called Brahman. Brahmeti, Paramatmeti, Bhagavan iti shabjate. The Shastras explain there are three realizations of God. One is the all-pervading, unmanifest, impersonal light of God. The other is the localized presence of God who is personally seated within everyone's heart. And the other is to understand the Lord, who is the supreme source of everything that exists, who is personally residing in the spiritual realm, engaging in eternal lila with his eternal associates. That is called Bhagwan. Now, it is like the difference between sun and sunshine. Can you say the sunshine is not the sun? The sunshine is the sun. The sunshine is all-pervading. It is everywhere. It is formless. But its source is coming from the localized sun. In the same way, the Shastras explain that Brahman, which is the goal taught by Sripad Shankaracharya, who we consider with all reverence as the incarnation of Lord Shiva, we accept that in this particular philosophy he is teaching how to liberate oneself from all material bondage, from all suffering, from all ignorance, and enter into the eternal light of transcendental consciousness, to enter into the sun, or the light of eternity. Now, according to the Bhagavad and the Vaishnava philosophers, it is explained that this is a partial realization of the Absolute Truth. Beyond freedom, which means to completely forget one's individuality and to simply merge into an existence, a formless existence, a deeper and higher realization of God than that is to realize our eternal loving relationship with the Lord. Which is higher, freedom or love? Within love is freedom. Within bhakti or prema, automatically liberation is included. But it is not an idle relationship. It is an eternally dynamic relationship. where the spirit soul eternally reciprocates in pure love in a totally liberated position with God. Just like, for instance, if a child is naughty, you tell him, go stand on the side of the room and don't do anything. But for the child to come back into the classroom and take part in the activities of the class is actually higher. To simply negate all illusion is freedom from the bondage of sin. Huh? But higher than just negation is accepting the positive, eternal, spiritual activities of the soul, which is service to God. So that is essentially the difference. We do not deny the philosophy, but according to the Shastra, we're simply explaining that if that's what you want, that's what you can have. But we are presenting that eternal loving relationship that the soul can have with God, where we have an eternal dynamic serving relationship with the Absolute Truth.
There's another thing, that the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita so far, there have been number of treatises on Gita, right from Adi Shankaracharya, even up to the modern saint Vinoba Bhave. In Prakrit also, there was the first treatise on Srimad Bhagavad Gita. That is known as Jnaneshwari. Now, in that also, the Bhakti Marga or the devotion Marga is very much emphasized. Now, so far as our knowledge goes, at least my knowledge goes, we have been taught that Gita philosophy is teaching us the Nishkama Karma Yoga. And the Krishna consciousness philosophy is very much stressing on the idol worship and Sankirtan. Now we have got in Maharashtra a very big, very famous sect known as Varkari Sampradaya. In that Sampradaya also, we worship the idol of Lord Vitthal, who is necessarily Lord Krishna himself. We also do lot of Kirtanam, Sankirtanam. Then there are number of Puran Kathas and all that. Now those are all Puran Kathas have, in a, up to some extent, they have disgraced our high philosophy as enunciated in various Upanishads and in all Vedic literatures. Now, the point is this, that every now and then, for the last whole week, we have been listening that the same stories of Puranas, which up to some extent have disgraced our original nature of scriptures. The scriptures which people when listened to, even practiced up to some extent, they were dancing with joy. And you have also just now said, when you started with your talk, that this is the land where the religion is now still there. So that philosophy, which is enunciated in all Upanishads and Vedic literature, and you are stressing so much on the idol puja, idol worship, how are we going to understand that? We have got a sect in Maharashtra, very much famous, very much quite enlarged, on a very large extent is existing in all over Maharashtra.
What does Krishna say in Gita? Krishna says in Gita, Bhaktyamam abhijananti yavan yascha smitatvata. It is only by devotion that you can know me in truth. No other way, Krishna says. Sixth chapter of Gita. I can go on like this all night, quoting Shastra from Gita. Krishna says in Gita, Yogi namapi saravesham madgaten antaratmana sharavan vajateyomam sameyuktatamamata. That of all yogis, one who worships me with faith and devotion is most intimately united with me in yoga and is highest of all.
Yes.
And Krishna also says to Arjuna, Bhaktosi me shakachesi dahasyam hetadutamam, that this knowledge, this supreme science, can be understood by you because you are my bhakta, you are my devotee. The Gita is simply a scripture of bhakti. It is a scripture of worship. What does worship mean? Krishna says in the ninth chapter, Yat karoshi yadashnashi, yaj juhoshi dadasiyat, yat tapasyasi kam. He says that all that you do, all that you eat, all that you offer and give away should be done as an offering to me, In this way, you are saying that Gita has been spoiled by bhakti? Gita is nothing but bhakti.
And
not only this, my dear sir, I also follow the teachings of Shankaracharya for many years. Have you ever been to Badrinath?
Pardon, sir?
Have you ever been to Badrikashram, Badrinath?
No, never.
That deity, a Badravishal, was installed by Sripad Shankaracharya. And below Badrinath is Joshimath. There's a deity of Lord Nrsingadev. That was Adi Shankaracharya's worshipable idol. That was his Ishtadev. He worshipped the murti of Lord Nrsingadev. And even his own followers, the Shankarites, accept that. The deities worshipped by the Shankarites. Adi Shankaracharya installed murtis, what you are saying idols, all over India. And he worshipped them. He taught how to worship them.
So I mean to say that it is not only worship of the idol. It is by your own meditation also you can attain him. Whereas in these lecture series we have observed that the word moksha is used as the preparatory to bhakti. Whereas our knowledge goes. Maybe
it is like this. When the sun rises, is there light?
Yes, there is light.
Similarly, when realization of God comes in our heart, automatically light, moksha, enlightenment takes place.
Moksha is the ultimate goal. It's the last stage. It is salvation. Whereas bhakti is a sort of a process.
Where in the Shastra does it say this?
It's a process.
Where in the Shastra does it say this? Ye ravindakshiva mukti maninas. It is said in the Shastra that mukti is the liberated state beyond duality of this world, but attainment of prema or bhakti is the positive entrance into the spiritual realm. This is what the Shastra says. We are simply repeating that. If you are seeking moksha, then you should seek moksha. We give all our blessings to you. We aren't arguing with you. Moksha is very good, but we are teaching bhakti. If you would like bhakti, we can give you bhakti. If you like moksha, we can give you that with bhakti. But if you want moksha without bhakti, then you find it and do it. Very good. Yes, Mataji.
Yes. Will you please guide us what is the way to do good work without the mixing of bad work, bad karmas?
You know, sometimes we do good work, but then we become proud that we have done it. And then it's all mixed up again. To realize you are not the doer, but you are the instruments in the hands of God, and you do His will, then our good work is pure. As long as we think, I am the doer of good work, we become proud. Then it becomes contaminated. But we realize, I am only the instrument. I am only the servant. God is the doer. If God did not give me the air, could I breathe? If God did not give the sun, could I see? If God did not give the rain, could I drink water? Could I eat food? If God did not give the earth, could I survive? Everything that we are made of is a gift of God. No scientist, no forefather has created what we are surviving on. The sunlight, the air, the rain, the earth, the food grains, our very body. Our mother and father did not produce this body. They were just instruments. It's not that our father invented semen by his own intelligence. Right? God invented this. God put the seed of life within that semen. And the father is just the instrument in God to put the semen in the mother. God made the womb. The womb was not made by the mother. And God, and the mother is, her womb is an instrument of God to let that seed that he planted grow. God has given us birth. God has made every hair on our head, every pore of our body. He's created it all. And everything we require to sustain it, he is giving us as a gift. The brain we have is a gift of God. Krishna says, I am the intelligency of the intelligent. I have the strength of the strong. He is everything. He's doing everything. He is the doer. But when we think, I'm the doer, then all karma. Sometimes we do good karma and I think I'm the doer of good karma, and you have to pay the pious results. Receive the pious results. Sometimes we think we're the doer of bad karma, and then, but when we purify our heart of this ego, then all of our karma is pure, divine, and spiritual. Huh? It's called akarma. There's karma, which means good work, vikarma, which means bad work, but they're both based on ego. And there's akarma, which means work in pure devotion to God. So how to attain that state? The only way is to purify your mind and purify your heart by spiritual practice. This practical method that any of us can apply to our life, we gradually become purified. And in that pure state, then everything we do, say, or think is simply an expression of God's love. Thank you.